This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 39. It's a great show for you today. We got Gordon Strong on again, one of my favorite guests. One quick announcement today, and that simply is Beersmith 2.1 is out, as also the new recipe sharing website is out. That's at beersmithrecipes.com. So if you go to beersmithrecipes.com, you can join, I think there's some 2,800 people that signed up in the first week, and they posted a few thousand recipes actually for you to search there. Many of those are public, so get on the new website and browse the new recipes. And also that's integrated totally with Beersmith 2.1 through a cloud view, so you can instantly download any of those recipes that you find online on the website and download them right into Beersmith and then scale them to your own equipment and use them that way. And now, without further ado, let's jump right into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Gordon Strong. He is a three-time Ninkasi Award winner, the author of Brewing Better Beer, an advanced home brewing book, also president of the BJCP, which is a beer judge certification program, and a Grandmaster Beer Judge. Gordon, it is fantastic to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So how have you been?
I've been great. Looking forward to getting to the NHC in Seattle.
Yeah, we got the Home Brewing Conference coming up here in just a few weeks. I'm really looking forward to that as well. Today we're going to talk a little bit about advanced beer brewing, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about it. I was wondering if you could focus on some of the things that, give us a few words about some of the things that you recommend to brewers once they get past the basics and they're really into, maybe developing their own recipes, doing all grain, those kinds of things. What are some of the things that they should focus on?
Yeah, a lot of people mistake sort of what happens when you become an advanced brewer. They think somehow you're going to get some vast amount of knowledge that you didn't have before. I say it's actually more about understanding and less about new knowledge. It's about really understanding cause and effect of the choices you make and what impact it has on your beer. With most topics that people learn, once you become more advanced, if you actually watch somebody doing it, it seems like they're just gliding through it. It seems like they're using a whole lot less effort, and there's a whole lot of wasted actions. So that's one of the things that I think it means when you're actually getting advanced, is that you stop rashing about what you're doing and you just sort of think it and do it. So to become more advanced, I think about more predictable outcomes, trying to not just have repeatability in your beer, but to also be able to sort of envision what you want to accomplish in a beer and know what choices you have to make to do that. I think it also involves understanding something about the style you're making, being able to assess the beer that you come out with, being able to sort of be your own feedback loop. So really, I think when you start to become an advanced brewer, it's more about editing yourself, I guess. Trying to get the tasks done as efficiently as possible.
Well, we were talking a little bit earlier about trying to, create an effect, if you will, in a beer. Mm-hmm. And how do you go about doing that? How do you go about creating an effect that you desire? Let's say you're targeting a particular style and you want A, B, or C to come out of it. How do you do that from ground zero?
There's the matter of the choice of ingredients and the recipe you put together, but also the process. I consider the act of brewing solving a number of tiny little problems strung together, and you sort of often have a free choice of the solution that you take to each of those problems, but they're related. So some of the choices you make on one area will certainly impact others. So being able to sort of think through, you know, your actions have meaning. So understanding what it is that, that you're trying to accomplish. But, you know, when I go about it, it's basically starting to understand what the target is, and then how do you make the choices that get you there? I try to make the big choices first, ones that sort of have more of a direct outcome on the finished product. So, you know, it's not sort of a methodical approach, because you can start with ingredients, you can start from process, but you do have to think about them both together. But I think I would say that you really have to be able to describe the qualities of the beer that you're trying to brew. Not just say, you know, I want to brew a good beer. Try to picture it a little bit better.
Good. Well, let's start out with brewing water. I know you have some pretty strong thoughts on toying with water, and you talk a little bit about that in the book. Would you share some of those thoughts with us?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of books for homebrewers would say, you know, water is an advanced topic, and it's something that you ought to think about after you've mastered some other areas first. And I tend to agree with that. There's been a lot of new information put out there, and people have tried to make it easy for brewers. They'll come up with spreadsheets and templates, and you know, you sort of fill in the blank about what you want to brew. I mean, some are even as simple as, you know, what color beer are you making, and then it tells you what you need to dump into your water to get there. But I think a lot of people sort of blindly use those without understanding the side effects of what they're trying to accomplish. Because I've seen a lot of spreadsheets, and you know, none of them actually have a column in there where they're trying to solve for best flavor. So you know, I don't know how they would do that, but I don't think they take into account the flavor impacts. You know, I've told this story before. I've probably even told it on one of your shows before. Mm-hmm. About judging the second round of the Nationals in Minnesota, where I was judging Oktoberfest beers, and you know, they looked gorgeous, but when you tasted them, it tasted like somebody had dropped an Alka-Seltzer in. You know, basically what it was is people were using water spreadsheets, and they were just over adjusting their water. You know, sure, they hit the color, but they missed the flavor. So, you know, congratulations, you got 3 points on appearance, and then you got, you know, 6 out of 20 on flavor.
Yeah.
So, you know, think about what's most important. So honestly, my thoughts about water are really, really based on the kind of water that I have. I live in Ohio, and we're sitting on top of a huge chunk of limestone, covers most of the Midwest. So my water is horrible for brewing. It has a lot of calcium carbonate in it, which mm-hmm. basically you don't want in your beer. So a lot of the techniques that I've come up with have been based on, well, what happens if I start with much more neutral water? What if I go buy reverse osmosis water? And I can go to like the grocery store here and get 5 gallons for like $1.95. So, you know, some people put in RO systems at their house and they can do it. But it's pretty easy for me just to go out and buy it for brewing.
Yeah, I had the same problem when I lived up in the mountains at one point, and we had just horrible water. It was so hard that virtually impossible to brew with. And I went to bottled water as well. So, I mean, do you recommend reverse osmosis water, distilled water, any particular style to start with? What do you use as a base, and what do you add to it to make it sort of neutral for brewing beer?
Well, this is where some of my thoughts, I think, differ from some of the other commentators. And I go at it based on how things taste. So I actually started experimenting with fewer water additions. You know, I wanted to make beer with as few mineral additions as possible and then see what that tasted like. So actually, the more I did that, the more I found that the flavor was better. So you know, this is the case where, you know, I sort of questioned some of the, you know, the sort of the brewing dogma. I actually went out and you know, tried making some IPAs and not dump a bunch of gypsum in it. You know, make a stout and don't dump a bunch of chalk in it. See what it tastes like. So some of the techniques that I'll talk about sort of start with me making the decision with water. So really what I do is I get this RO water, which is essentially neutral, and I add in enough minerals to facilitate the mash. So really what I'm looking for is about 50 parts per million of calcium. And it can be calcium from any source. I tend to use either calcium chloride or calcium sulfate, depending on the beer style. But I think mm-hmm. calcium chloride actually has the fewest flavor side effects. So unless I'm trying to add a particular flavor to the beer, I will tend to use calcium chloride. And I also don't want to overdo the measurements. I looked up some weights in chemistry books and, you know, did some experiments and found out that for you know, a 5-gallon batch, it's, you know, roughly a teaspoon is what I want to throw in the mash of either calcium chloride or calcium sulfate or a mix of the two. And I figure that gives me, you know, somewhere around 50 parts per million. You know, whether it's 50 or 55 or 70, you know, it's not going to make that big of a difference. Actually, it's probably going to make you know, not a difference at all. So, you know, I don't bother weighing things out on gram scales. I do the approximation of just measuring it in a teaspoon.
Right, but I guess one of your main points is a little bit goes a long way here. I mean, literally just a yes. couple grams of water additions is enough to carry you through in most cases.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, you know, the volume that a teaspoon is, you know, it's not very much at all. So, and that, you know, that's on top of neutral water. Mm-hmm. So, so what I tend to do is I'll take the first thing I'll do with my brewing water is I adjust it with phosphoric acid to a pH of 5.5. And I've determined through experimentation that that's roughly a quarter teaspoon of 10% phosphoric acid in 5 gallons of RO water. Gets me around there. And again, it doesn't matter if it's 5.5 or 5.7 or 5.3. I just want it to be below 6 and above 5. So. That's the first, I guess, if you think about what do I do to water, the first thing I do, I guess, is I adjust it with phosphoric acid. So I drop the pH. That's something I learned at Sierra Nevada. And if you think about why people are adding salts to water when they make beer styles, it's like they're trying to drive the mash pH to a certain range. But later in the process, like when you sparge, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of advice about, you know, how much you sparge and when you should stop and all that. And that's all about extracting unwanted tannins. And really, that only happens when the temperature is above 170 and the pH is above 6. So if I make the pH always below 6, you know, I could sparge as long as I wanted, and I'm not going to be extracting tannins out of it. It really doesn't matter. So I took something that, you know, a lot of people worry about, and I just, you know, got it out of the equation entirely. So So I treat all my brewing water with the phosphoric acid. And then I just add the salts in the mash. Mm-hmm. So don't add it to the water that I put into the mash. I actually, you know, add it in with the grain in the mash tun, because I want to make sure that those salts are in with the grain when the mash is going on.
Right.
So then later, if I'm making a beer style that actually has sort of a certain mineral profile, I might add some of those salts to the boil, not to the mash. Because really, you're adding the salts in the mash because you're trying to drive the pH to hit a certain range.
Right.
But, you know, when you're in the boil, I mean, the mash is over. So, you know, you don't have to worry about that at all. So really, I consider that the equivalent of, you know, making soup or stew or chili or something. I mean, you're just basically, you know, adding spices, you're seasoning to taste. So if you want it to have a certain flavor, you know, you could add some of that in later. But at least you know you're not going to throw off your mash chemistry.
Right.
So, you know, I make these choices to simplify what happens in the mash.
Well, let's talk a little bit about grains then. What? Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, it's the perfect tie-in because.
Oh, okay.
you can't consider, you know, water on its own.
Right, because I mean, if you add grains in, it immediately changes the pH level, right?
Absolutely.
And you're shooting for that magic 5.1 or so.
In the 5.1 to 5.5 range.
Somewhere in that range when you're in the mash. And so why don't you talk for a minute about grains and how they affect the process in the mash, and then also talk about how they affect the process, you know, as we're targeting a particular style or a particular flavor.
Right. So, I'll start with I don't know if this is a question because I haven't formed it in my head yet, but sort of an observation. So when people were, you know, we're talking about all grain brewing here, right? So,
mm-hmm.
Let's go back to when you started brewing. I mean, when people start out brewing, if they're brewing extract beers, you know, you're not mashing your grains at all, right?
Yeah, you're steeping them typically.
Right. So you have two things. I mean, you have cans of syrup or bags of powder, and mm-hmm. you have some grain that you put in bags and you steep.
Right. So maybe 20, 30 minutes, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, what kind of grains do you put in the bag and steep?
Typically specialty grains. So, I mean, typically you're using darker grains, chocolate malts, caramel malts, things like that.
Yeah. Your crystal malts, your chocolate malts, your roast malts, those kind of things. I mean, you're putting them in there because they don't need to be mashed.
Right.
So now, fast forward, you're an all-grain brewer. Why do you mash all your grain? I mean, you weren't mashing them before.
Right.
Why do you feel a need to mash them now? I mean, technically, you're not actually mashing them. You're just taking these grains and you're just like leaving them around there for a while.
Right, because they don't contribute that much to fermentables, typically.
Well, actually they do. They do not as much as the base grains, but
right.
The enzymes don't need to do anything to that in the mash. All you're doing is rinsing them off.
Right.
So, I mean, if the goal of the mash is to have the enzymes convert starches to sugars, you know, just put in the starches that need to be converted in the mash. You know, I started thinking about, you know, how dark grains change over time. And it's more than just adding color. It's use chocolate malt. I mean, yeah, you're adding a sort of a chocolate or coffee flavor, but I mean, there's a quality of the flavor as well. You know, the analogy I use is, you know, suppose you make a pot of fresh coffee and, you know, you get a cup after it's just been made, and then you have, you know, a pot that's been sitting on a burner for 2 hours. You know, how's that flavor going to change? You know, it's going to be more acidic. It's going to be harsher. It's just going to be nastier. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities between coffee and dark roasted grains. So if you don't want to expose your coffee to a lot of heat over time. Why do you want to do that with your dark grain?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about taking the dark grains out of the equation, then think about also how does that impact your choices with water? When people have these spreadsheets, especially the sort of the color-based spreadsheets, you say, you know, if you're making a stout, you have to add all this chalk to your beer because it needs to sort of neutralize the acidity in the dark grains.
Right, because the darker grains are highly acidic.
Right. So suppose you don't put the dark grains in the mash. You don't need to add those offsetting water salts to the mash
mm-hmm.
because you're basically mashing a pale beer. So you can get away with a lot less water additions because you're not throwing off the pH of the mash. So you can add those darker grains in later.
So you take the darker grains and either add them at the end of the mash or do you steep them in a separate tea or something like that?
Yeah, you can do them either way. I mean, the easiest way. I'll answer one of my own questions from earlier. So, if you're an all grain brewer, how come you mash all your dark grains? It's like, well, because it's easiest. You mill all your grains together. You don't have to worry about separating them out, and you throw them in together. And you're just assuming that there's no, negative effects to having the dark grains and the crystal malts being around. But I sort of contend that there are negative effects. Causes you to add these extra salts and it can make the character of those grains seem awfully harsh. So if you yank them out, then sort of the easiest way to put them back in, what I do, probably 3 out of 4 times, is I'll just throw them in during the Vorloff when I'm recirculating. Basically.
So that'd be right at the very end of the mash, just as you're starting to sparge, right?
Yeah, I mean, I do a mash out in most of my beers, so mm-hmm. I'm either direct firing the mash tun or I'm adding in some, extra hot water. That's a perfect time to be adding in those grains. So I just throw them right on the top of the mash, and then I'll just if I'm sparging, I'll just sparge on top of that. Or if I'm batch sparging, I'll just add in the water and let it sit there for 10-15 minutes and then run it off.
Now, Gordon, I read about this in your book, and one of the questions I had is how dark how dark are we talking about? Do you how far down do you go in terms of pulling them out of the mash? Do you pull out your light crystal grains? Do you pull out do you go all the way down to pulling out Vienna malt and Munich malt, or how far down do you go?
I think about whether or not the grain actually needs to be mashed.
Mm-hmm.
Vienna malts and Munich malts need to be converted. So
yeah.
They have to be mashed. So they would be in the mash. So crystal malts don't. Any sort of roasted malt. So, basically, you can look at the malt spec sheet or mm-hmm. the maltster's website and see, for the malt, they should always list the diastatic power of the malt.
Right.
Which basically is the amount of enzymes that are present. So if you see that it doesn't have any, then they're basically saying that it doesn't need to be mashed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just adding a color and flavor contribution, not a starch that needs to be converted. There is you do get gravity points out of those special grains.
Right. Most of the starches have already been caramelized, so they're readily broken sure. down.
Right. Certainly with the crystal malts, you can taste them.
Yeah.
They taste sweet.
Yeah.
The sugars are there. So, that's sort of where I draw the line. And actually, the interesting thing is there's been some studies about the relationship of color to pH, and this probably throws off some of the spreadsheets, but crystal malts actually have more acidity per unit of color than darker malts.
Interesting. So,
yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. I would have guessed that I would have guessed that a lot of the darker malts were contributing more acidity than, well, than say a crystal malt.
Well, they probably they do on a on an absolute basis. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of adjust it by the, you know, the units of color they're providing. So I mean, if you get like a dark crystal and a light chocolate, you know, the crystal will be more acidic than the chocolate, even if they're similar colors. Mm. So yeah, I don't know why, but
interesting.
You know, just sort of saw that. So, you know, it's not just a dark malt issue. You know, it does impact your crystal malts.
Okay, so you recommend steeping your grains, right? Especially the darker ones. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I throw them in during the recirculation or during the sparge, but you can also sort of steep them separately outside of the mash entirely, and then strain them off, sort of like making cold pressed coffee. And then that resulting liquid you have, you could add any time during the boil or even at the end of the boil. So it depends on how much heat you want those things to see. Like I said, I tend to do the lazier thing and throw them in the recirculation rather than doing a separate steep, just because that's a separate process and you have to do it the day before.
Okay, so what are some other ways of getting the most out of your grains? I think you had a couple other thoughts you mentioned in the book.
Yeah, so the whole idea of the handling of the dark grains, I think, is the most important one, because that one has sort of an impact on the water chemistry and things you're doing there, and it also has something to do like with the flavor profile, like the quality of the roast. Yes, I think there's sort of a less harshness to it. So I think the you know, I touched on sort of this quality statement. Mm-hmm. But let me tie that into sort of harshness, because that's sort of the general theme that I use in brewing, is like, I really don't like harsh beers. I don't like beers with a coarse bitterness. I don't like astringent beers. I don't like the sort of rough flavor profile. So I'm making choices to try to avoid that character. You know, that's sort of like a secondary objective to anything else I'm doing.
So how do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, I talked about how sometimes you can extract tannins, which give you astringency if your water is the pH is too high when you're sparging. So you know, I do that. The idea of the handling of the dark grains, though, is let me follow up on that coffee analogy.
Sure.
The longer you let hot coffee sit on a hot plate, you know, the more acidic it gets, but also the quality of that coffee flavor starts heading south. It starts mm-hmm. starts picking up more bitterness and astringency. Astringency is often interpreted as bitter, because it does have sort of a bitter edge to it, but there's a, you know, it's more than bitter, it's harsh. So I make this statement about you know, understand the quality of the flavor, the quality of the bitterness, the quality of all the flavor components you have in your beer. So, you know, I do that when I handle hops as well, you know, it comes into it. But, you know, the big thing when dealing with the grains is avoiding, if you're using darker grains, think about trying not to cook them as much. You know, every time you think about it, just think about like the coffee sitting on the burner. You know, if you ever worked in an office building where, you know, the hot plate coffee was sitting there, especially if it sort of boils away and sort of burns into it, it's just one of the nastiest smells there is. So, you know, trying to avoid doing that to your beer. So be gentle with your darker grains. So try to avoid overheating them. Mm-hmm. So the follow up on a quality statement again. Mm-hmm. There are things that I do to beer in general, not just handling the dark grains. If I'm trying to boost the malt flavor and get sort of a cleaner profile. So one of the things that I often do in malty beer styles is sort of a no sparge technique. What that really is you jack up the grain bill on your recipe, and then you don't sparge. You conduct your mash normally and just run it off. And if you collect less than your target volume, you just top it off with water rather than sparging your beer. Because you're using more malt, you're going to get more gravity points out of it. But the first runnings that you get out of your grain are going to have a higher quality flavor. Mm-hmm. So if I'm making like an ESB or a Bock or something like that, something where I really want the malt to sort of stand out. I often pull out this technique. It's more costly because you have to use some more grains, say 1/3 to 40% more.
Now, when you're doing that kind of a technique, do you actually mash at a higher water to grain ratio, or are you still mashing at 1.25, 1.5 quarts per pound?
I don't really mess with the ratios that much. And often, somebody asked me this question in the last week or so about mash thickness. Honestly, I think mash thickness is one of those areas that people don't need to mess around with that much. I don't think it has that big of an impact on your beer. I tend to use thinner mashes the more I brew. Seems like I get like a more even temperature distribution across the whole grain bed during the mash than when I mash thick.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about brewing a bag, which is done with a full volume mash. So typically at twice the ratio that that you might do for a typical mash that we would use today. And those beers come out just fine, even at that ratio, even doubling the amount of water you have per unit of grain.
Oh yeah, I was in Australia 2 years ago, and then it's huge there. And I actually took part in a tasting panel where they had brew in a bag versus a traditional three-tier system versus somebody with some high-tech brewing system.
I guess it shouldn't be a big surprise because, the Germans have been using these very high water to grain ratios in traditional decoction for many, many years, hundreds of years, actually. So it's not like we're doing anything terribly new here.
That's actually something I often cite as well, is like the Germans mash thin because they need to pump the mash between vessels.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the earlier techniques that homebrewers in America wound up with were English techniques where they tended to mash thicker. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where, people just sort of got that as this is the way you have to do it. But, I tell people, look, it's not going to make that big of a difference. Go ahead and, I find it easier to work if it's thinner. Mm-hmm. The temperature distribution is better. It's easier to stir. It's easier to move around. And you don't have to sparge as much.
Well, I want to save a few minutes at the end to go through a couple of your sample beers. So let's move on to hops now. What tips do you have for hop techniques, applying hops to your beer and so on?
Yeah, I think, again, sort of following on the theme of trying to avoid harshness in the beer. So there's a couple of techniques that I tend to use there. I'll look at first work hopping, so adding the hops to the kettle when you first start lautering.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite techniques to use as well. I use it all the time, especially on lighter beers.
Yeah, you just get this huge flavor dimension, and it's such a smooth bitterness. I don't know how you account for it in your program, but people have asked before, is like, how do you account for a first work edition? So, I mean, if you actually take the beer and send it off to the lab and have them measure the IBUs, it measures out like it's a 65-minute edition, basically.
Yeah, it measures out, 10% higher, I think, is sort of what the literature supports. But, of course, from a perspective of taste, it's not the case, right?
It doesn't taste that way at all. No. So, I mean, this is where, IBUs aren't equal. I mean, it tastes to me more like a 60-minute boil. It measures at 65 as a 65 edition, but to me, it sort of tastes more like a 20-minute edition.
Yeah, actually, on last week's show, the last show that I did, we were talking hop chemistry. And it was interesting because, he talked about how IBUs really only measure one dimension of hop flavor, basically the alpha acids.
Right.
Whereas there's probably something like 300 different flavor compounds that come from hops that actually go into a beer. And so you're measuring one out of those 300 flavor compounds. And it's the one number doesn't tell the whole story any more than one color number tells the whole story of color of the beer,
Yeah, sure. I mean, IBUs are bitter, but they're not the only thing that are bitter.
Not at all.
So that's where I get into this quality of the bitterness statement. And I think the first work hopping sort of plays into that because you get such a clean bitterness. You don't get any of this harshness or coarseness. And sometimes you have some of these West Coast IPA kind of things, and they're just so coarse that you're tasting every last one of those IBUs. And then you have somebody else that makes one, and it measures out way higher than it tastes because it tastes so clean. So I really like that clean bitterness character. So I like the first wort hopping, and I often combine that, although I can use these techniques independently, with all late hopping. So basically doing no additions more than 20 minutes from the end. So, don't do, what you might think of as a bittering hop addition at 60 minutes.
Yeah, we discussed that a little bit in last week's show as well. When the hop chemistry, it turns out there's a number of hop oils that that are fragile that boil off in, say, 10 minutes. Some of them even boil off in a couple minutes. So you end up losing all those things if you do these long boil additions.
Yeah, and the oils are going to be more driving the flavor and the aroma. But when you do your IBU calculations, it turns out you just have to use more. But in these certain styles, I tend to like that more because you're emphasizing this, nice fresh hop flavor and aroma. So those are some techniques that I do. I've also found the more I brew, the less I dry hop. I mean, I've gotten away from dry hopping almost entirely nowadays.
Really? Why is that?
Because I don't care for the sort of the grassy vegetal kind of character that you get.
Mm-hmm.
I want the fresh hop oils, but the analogy I have here is, if you ever cook Indian food, there's a big difference between if the spices actually see some heat before you cook versus if you just added them at the end when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between a raw and a cooked flavor. Or if you've ever had somebody thicken something with flour and you don't cook it out, you get this tasty flour taste. So, you don't always want raw taste in your beer. So what I find myself doing more is these all late additions, or even more what I see commercial breweries do is the Whirlpool edition. And even if you don't have a Whirlpool as a home brewer, sort of what I do on my system is I turn off the heat and then I'll give it a stir and then I'll go away for 15 or 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're not moving around, but it's sitting in there. It's not boiling, but, it's still sitting there when it's warm. And, it's it since there's actually no boil going on, sort of the volatile aromatics aren't getting driven out.
Right.
There's, you know, the scrubbing bubbles from boiling aren't present. So, I find a Whirlpool edition or these all late editions sort of give me a better quality of hop aroma and flavor than I get with dry hopping. I don't like that sort of grassy character.
So using them at flame out, again, when the beers are the worts at a very high temperature, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, it's, so before you start to cool it.
Boiling.
Right. Well, I wanted to save a few minutes, I think I said at the end, to walk through a couple examples. So I was wondering maybe if you could just sort of walk us through a couple of your recipe examples and explain as you're going through it, you know, what was your rationale for maybe picking this particular ingredient or using this particular technique as you're brewing the beer?
Sure. So I made a couple of beers last fall following, you know, tips in my book, basically things I wanted to drink, American pale ale and a brown porter. Mm-hmm. So I got to use a lot of the techniques that we talked about in the pale ale. So first off, the grain bill, I'm looking at something that is roughly 90% sort of a neutral base malt and 10% light Munich. And the sort of the 90% base malt is sort of split evenly between American two row and German Pilsner malt. So the rationale there is I wanted something with more interest than just simple American two row, but I didn't want it so malty that it was going to distract from the hops.
Right.
So I've gotten away from using English malts in my American pale ales. I don't, you know, I love Marisadder as a malt, but mm-hmm. I don't like to use it in American pale ale because it adds too much of a bready, biscuity flavor that I think clashes a little with the hops. So I think, you know, the combination of American two row and German Pilsner malt is a little bit of Munich malt. Gives you like a very beautiful golden color, mm-hmm. which is, you know, I want my pale ales to be pale. I don't want them to be amber or copper.
Right.
So I use that for the grain. I'm shooting for about a 1050 beer. And then for hops, I use the combination of first wort hopping. So I use maybe a half ounce first wort hop. I've got additions at 20, 10, 1, and 0. So, where I would ordinarily dry hop beer, I'm just adding all that at flame out and letting it sit for 20 minutes. So I treated my water like I talked about with the phosphoric, and I used like a half teaspoon of calcium chloride and a half teaspoon of calcium sulfate in the mash. So the hop choice I used, and people should be able to find this hop now if they go out and look for it, is I used Galaxy, which is the hop from Australia.
Yep, Galaxy. I'm familiar with it.
It has a beautiful passion fruit flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mixed that with a little bit of Cascade. And it's just a really lovely drinkable beer. There's no crystal malts in here. There's no body malts. I mashed for like 30 minutes at 144 and 30 minutes at 153, sort of more of a German style step mash. Because I wanted to be well attenuated. I don't like my pale ales to be heavy.
So it sounds like you're shooting for a really clean, smooth drinking beer here, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I finished it off with I fermented it with actually English ale yeast, the 1968 London ESB yeast. At 62 degrees. So, it keeps the esters down, but it gives a little bit more interest than just the American cheek yeast. So, this is a favorite of mine. This is actually sort of the beer I'm drinking here. Somebody else made this recipe and sent me a bottle. I'm liking it a lot.
Excellent. Well, hopefully would you mind if I put it in the show notes or put it on my new, beersmithrecipes.com site?
Yeah, you can put that, you can put that recipe out there.
I'll try and get it posted both places. I'll put a link in the show notes for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. And
again, I'm going to be I'll be pouring this at the NHC during my talk. So if any of your listeners are out there for that, stop in.
I'll definitely be there as well. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, awesome.
And your second beer?
Yeah, the second one is a brown porter. So, I mean, I talked about this one a little bit on the porter show I did with you. So this one has sort of less of the techniques involved. But what I'm doing here is I'm using the steeping of the dark grains. But, I mean, I'm treating my water almost identically. So think about it. I've got American pale ale and I've got a brown porter. Now, would people's recipe spreadsheets tell you to use the same water salts in both?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one had a teaspoon of calcium chloride in it, but the water was treated, phosphoric the same way. So this one has a base of Maris Otter.
Excellent.
A little bit of Munich to bump up the maltiness. But really here, the flavor is being carried by three malts. I've got some English brown malt, which if people haven't used, I really, really recommend for a porter. It gives that that flavor that's, if you've ever tried like a Fuller's London Porter, it has this sort of unmistakable flavor that's
hard. Hard to find brown malt in some places, but brown malt originally was the base for all porters, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
But the brown malt we have nowadays probably isn't anything like that.
No.
It doesn't have any diastatic power in it. So
the originals were all kilned over wood, too. They didn't have coke fired either, so they probably had a pretty smoky flavor, but that's back in the early 1700s.
So I use the brown malt, I use English Crystal 60, and I use some English chocolate malt. And there's no dark malt, there's no black malt or anything like that. And all these were added at the recirculation.
Right.
And here, it's almost the same size beer. It's this is a 1054 beer, but it finished higher. Because it's got some crystal malt in it.
Crystal malt's
in fermentables. So same 1968 yeast. So I brewed two very different beers using similar water, similar process, similar yeast and handling. But I think people, if you've been adding a lot of salts to your water, try making beer with very minimal additions and see if you like it. If you like the flavor, I recommend that with a lot of things that people do. Make your coffee without using high mineral water. Mm-hmm. Cook your pasta in low mineral water. Mm-hmm. Do anything where the water is going to come through. Try using low mineral and see if you like the flavor better.
Excellent. Well, Gordon, we're actually running low on time, but I thought I'd ask if there's anything else you wanted to add quickly. I'll make sure I get both those recipes posted.
Yeah, I'd be happy to try these if anybody made them and wanted to offer them to me. I've had some of these that people have made, and it's a very interesting evaluation process. So I love when people try the recipes and tell me what they think, especially if they're trying new techniques or they're trying things that they always thought they were told not to do.
Yeah.
So, I love shattering those, sort of the brewers are going with the myth busters. Don't be afraid to go out and try some of these techniques and see if it simplifies your brewing.
Sure.
And if you happen to be in Seattle for the NHC, come by and I'll sign a book and, talk to me about, what beers you're making. Cause I'd love to have, brewers come out and talk to me about how they've put these techniques into practice.
Well, I'll be doing the same. I've got a booth this year too, so you're welcome. Gordon can come and hang out at my booth if he wants.
Oh, I'll definitely do that.
Look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast.
Yeah. Well, Gordon, thank you once again for showing up and doing the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Well, it's always fun to sit around, have a beer, and talk about beer. So all my favorites all wrapped together.
Thank you. And I look forward to seeing you in a month or so, and look forward to hearing more of your talk at that point. And again, my guest today was Gordon Strong. He's a 3-time Ninkasi Award winner, which for those of you who don't know, is the top home brewer in the United States. Pretty big accomplishment. He's also the president of the BJCP, and he is the highest level Grandmaster Beer Judge in the world. So thank you, Gordon. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you again to Gordon Strong for doing that great interview. Really appreciate him being on the show once again. Reminder, if you haven't got Beersmith 2.1, go ahead and download it from our website or visit our new recipe site at beersmithrecipes.com. Want to remind you that Beersmith 2.1 is a free download if you've already got Beersmith 2.0. Also want to remind you, the new website at beersmithrecipes.com, you can create a free basic account there. It doesn't cost you a dime, so join in and comment on some recipes and find your friends. Enjoy that new site. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.